One. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Peter Llewellyn. I run the services at medcomsnetworking.com, and the associated website. So, information, resources, activities for people who work in and around the global medical communications, medical education, medical publishing type businesses, and the associated businesses. We also do a lot of work for people who want to come into Medcoms, maybe as a medical writer or as an account manager and so on. So, lots of information for you at First Medcoms job. It's worth having a look at Network Pharma TV, where we have more than 500 videos now on all sorts of matters around Medcoms. So there's lots of resource to go and have a look at. A lot of those videos, in fact, in Network Pharma TV are generated from webinars like this. We're regularly having speakers and panelists from all over the world. Today, I'm delighted we've got Matt in from the States. We're going to be talking about AI, which is why we've got a particularly large audience today from all over the world. Matt, I'm not going to steal your thunder. We're just going to have a conversation here. But let's just start with you telling us about yourself, Matt, and just paint a little bit of the picture of INIZIO, because not everyone will know much about INIZIO. But importantly, from your point of view, tell us about your journey. And my key question, I mean, how does a man in Medcoms end up with a job title that's Global Chief Artificial and Augmented Intelligence Officer? That's a grand sounding title. So please just introduce yourself and talk a bit about how you got there.
First, Peter, thank you so much for having me on the show. I've been a long time watcher, listener, audience member, all the rest, and it's really like a true pleasure and honor to be here as a panelist. It's really like a dream come true. So thank you so much for having me on today. I've been in life sciences my entire career, which is 25 years. Most of that time in medical affairs. I started in medical about 23-ish years ago as a field medical science liaison. I've been in almost every role you can be in home office medical, from CME to investigator-initiated studies to opinion leaders, advisory boards, publications, grants. It launched a number of molecules still on the client side. I was at a company that became part of AbbVie. Worked at Boehringer Ingelheim for a number of years, both in the States as well as in Germany. Switched on to the kind of consulting agency side back in the late 2000s or so, and had really a number of kind of leadership roles, both in product strategy as well as in client services, analytics. Worked in MedComms directly, SciComms, especially over the last really 15 years for really groups like Adelphi, both in the US and the UK, which some folks on the phone I know are affiliated with, as well as at Omnicom, in ProEd. I ended up taking on the role of Executive Vice President, Global Practice Lead for Apothecom, running SciComm and Pubs back in 2015, and then started the analytics team here, what became our data analytics group back in 2016. And really, it started with a similar kind of question that led to what ultimately became our AI practice, which is what is really the effect of, and how can we optimize or make better the communications work that we're doing across the full kind of book of business that we serve in order to really speed time to decision for clinicians, patients, and other stakeholders. And I think, a lot of the groups we were working with really found value in the communications that we were supporting, but they couldn't kind of tell which areas were most impactful or that were of the things that they were supporting. They didn't know, what, say, physicians or researchers or investigators or payers or other groups actually did with that content when they actually read it or they saw it in their environments, and they came to us kind of curious to learn more. And we started our analytics practice just as a way of helping to answer some of those kind of burning questions in the minds of leadership in the biopharma and biotech and medical device and digital therapeutic space, to try to see if we could give them some support for the value proposition questions of how that evidence was really translating into value.
Go on, yes, go. Yeah, keep going. You
So yeah, so
haven't got
I
to the end
mean,
of
I
the
think
journey yet.
it's the journey. So I mean, I think it was the case, like a number of years ago when we did this work, 7, 8 years ago or so, that to answer that question, it was the way that many kind of research and analytics and data firms are. And I think I saw a number of folks as they were joining the call today, people that I've known for a while out in the world, that a lot of this work is it begins like with a mixed methods consideration of qual quant kind of approach. In our world, it was quite similar. We had a lot of that kind of baked into the approach, but we also leveraged early on some considerations applications in the AI sleeve, things like natural language processing. And we got involved quite early in things like machine learning and deep learning. And, you know, it was one of our tools. You know, it wasn't the only thing we did, but, you know, we did a fair amount of artificial intelligence work in part of the practice. And I think if, you know, we started in 2016 and maybe AI was, you know, maybe 10% of what we did in 2016, maybe a quarter in 2017, maybe a third in 2017, so on and so forth. By the time I left the practice earlier this year, you know, probably at least 85-90% of what we were doing was AI enabled or AI powered to some extent. And I think, you know, the world was very different 5, 6, 7 years ago. You know, it was often the case that when we would work on a major project, regardless of kind of what the functional area was or what the, you know, brief looked like, you know, on behalf of a client team, it often wasn't the case that a group would come to us and say, you know, what we really want is this, you know, AI thing or this AI deliverable. No one really asked for that. It wasn't until, honestly, within the last maybe 6 months that we even saw a request where the word AI or the phrase AI right. was even explicitly mentioned. But, you know, what people did care about was that we were being efficient with resources, that we were finding a way to extract value from the consideration. And often it was an artificial intelligence mechanism to pull that through. And we have an intact data science team that could help support that request. And, you know, in many cases, the groups with whom we work didn't even, I think, sometimes know that what we were doing was AI, if you will. They just yeah. knew that what we were doing was valuable and it was able to then scale and kind of really be generalizable and considered, you know, a part of the way we worked and the products and services that we were able to support. I think, you know, with the end of last year with ChatGPT emerging on the scene and people's kind of temperature and kind of tenor for AI increasing a bit, now that those questions started to increase a bit, where folks were saying, well, you know, we'd like actually like you to do this, but we want you to do it using AI. And like, we're already doing that. Right. But, you know, it was just more of a kind of pulling back the curtain a little bit and saying, yeah, we're already doing that. We've been doing it for 7+ years and we have hundreds of projects that are completed in that realm, which is no one ever cared enough to ask us how it was being done. So it was more of a kind of just kind of being transparent about how the work actually got completed. And then, you know, it got to the point where, you know, starting really late last year, you know, November, December of last year, the beginning of this year, where our practice, which was a mix of some digital consulting, some software as a service, some advanced analytics, and kind of a discussion about what's possible with artificial intelligence, the amount of time that was being requested by executives out in the space and by professional societies and other third parties got to the point where I was literally spending probably 12, 13 hours a day deep in on the practice. And then probably another 4 or 5 hours a day every day from, you know, late US Thanksgiving till US Valentine's Day, that 3-4 month period, working probably another 5 hours on top of the 12 hours every day, just to kind of keep up with what was evolving in the AI space. And my boss, who's been on this show, came to me and said, you know, this isn't tenable. You can't really work, you know, 12, 13 hours a day deep in on a, you know, digital consulting advanced analytics practice, and then also be, you know, kind of building this kind of artificial intelligence bolus kind of around it as well. You know, would it potentially make sense to divorce the two and have someone else come on and take on the advanced analytics role as president potentially, and then you focus just on artificial intelligence exclusively? And I'm like, I hadn't never really thought about that, but that sounds like a reasonable plan. And that's what we ended up doing. We hired someone to come on as president of the Medical Analytics Innovation Group. And as of April, I was promoted to Chief AI Officer, which has this long title. It wasn't a title that I selected, but it's Global Chief Artificial and Augmented Intelligence Officer. And I just, when people ask me what it is, I just say head of AI or chief AI officer, right. But I think it reflects the kind of evolution of the space, because some people still kind of gravitate towards artificial intelligence as like what they're interested in or what they're doing. But our disposition is more focused on augmented intelligence, where it's the subject matter expert, the medical strategist, the person that's a professional in role partnering with AI to achieve this synergistic vision of the two working together better than either alone. That's the augmented component. So having both in my title gives a, you know, kind of a path of travel, if you will, for folks that are a little bit less kind of clear on kind of where we are, what we believe in. So it is a bit of a mouthful, but it does hopefully give folks a little bit of a sense as to what we stand for.
Okay, but it also reflects, I guess, the sort of size and type of organization you're a part of. Can just say a few words about Inizio, because I mean, a lot of people will know Inizio, but equally, there'll be people watching this who aren't that familiar with the business, and they'll be more familiar with, frankly, smaller medcoms agencies. You know, what you're representing, it does fall out of the fact that Inizio is very large. You know, it's on a different scale to most medcoms agencies. So just say a few words about the evolution and the setup of the business.
Sure. Yeah. So as I mentioned before, so I've been here for almost 8 years. And when I joined, I joined as head of the SICOM and pub sleeve within Apothecom. So Inizio has been out to market for just about a year and a half or so. We were formed by a private equity firm that had acquired a number of the constituent parties at an earlier point. The groups that folks will be familiar with are probably, at least within the Medcom sleeve, Ashfield, Nucleus, and Medistrava slash Apothecom. And then across the overall Inizio, the corporate Inizio, where we have really kind of four major groups, which are marketing, communications, medical, which I just referenced, Engage, which is really a kind of experiences and kind of training organization and advisory. And within advisory, there are a number of other business units that people will probably have some familiarity with, like STEM and Vynamic and Putnam and Smart Analysts and other groups like that. But across the overall organization, probably around 15,000 or so people, and just deep in on life sciences and health. So unlike Omnicom, where I used to work for 8 years, or WPP, where I was for a bit, which have very extensive professional services organizations, but serve, you know, really all verticals, if you will. And we only focus on life sciences and health. We don't have any customers outside of healthcare and life sciences. And really, as a result, represent both the deepest and broadest bench within that space. So to your point, I think having a kind of a dedicated role for artificial intelligence across the medical sleeve within Inizio makes sense because of our size and scale. But you know, when I was first appointed to the role in the spring, there really weren't any other similar roles across industry or across the professional services space. But I have been seeing over the last couple of months a number of similar appointments within, especially the holding company level. There's a similar person that has a role like mine at WPP. There's someone that just got announced similarly within Omnicom at the bigger kind of company level. And I think it is an evolving trend that most of the major companies will have chief AI officers, either with that title or something like, you know, head of AI or something similar. It's a both an inflection point for the space at large, and also a little bit of a departure from the way that business was done up until this point, where, you know, AI, as I was just mentioning, like a lot of our teams did AI. We have data science teams, but the way that the business requested the work to be done, or that our clients saw it kind of being carried out, was perhaps a bit, you know, centralized, a bit kind of removed from the rest of the work. And now, as AI is evolving to more of an organizational consideration, having that kind of expectation live, you know, across the organization really does demand a kind of strategic role, an executive consideration, and really some contributions to help the organization at large consider how to upskill, consider, you know, what it means across the full portfolio of services and solutions, consider, you know, long-term strategy and the rest. It's becoming less of a tactic, I guess you could say, and more of a kind of transformative catalyst. And I've really seen that over the last, definitely over the last year, but certainly over the last 8 years, where like people, it used to be like a nice thing, like, you know, oh, we could, you know, throw a little AI at it, you know, 6, 7 years ago. Now it's really like an imperative. If you don't have an AI consideration within and across the business, especially in our space, it's going to become a challenge moving forward.
Okay, we're probably going to have to be a little bit careful with this discussion, partly because we haven't got a lot of time. AI can cover all sorts of things, you know, and lots of people are very confused about the terminology and what's AI or versus machine learning or whatever. I mean, a lot of the focus is on the sort of chat GPT type tools, and you know, we've already had questions coming in about how can we use those sorts of tools, and maybe we can get in over the course of the conversation, we can have some specific examples of how people can start using those tools. But I did want to effectively start by addressing the fact that you are, I mean, you know, the AI environment has changed dramatically in the last 6 months. And, you know, one of the calls has been for professional organizations in our industry to be providing guidance. So I think an important part of today is for you, if you don't mind, just to talk through, as far as I know, there's three, important initiatives that you're part of with Healthcare Communications Association, ISMAP, and MAPS, the Medical Affairs Professionals. Can you just give us some top line? I mean, all those organizations are trying to help their memberships work out how to use AI, and there's a strong element of how to use things like medical writing AI tools. In all three cases, there's, or let's say, there's varying degrees of openness. Some of it is just they're talking to their members only, and some of them are a bit more open. But I think it's relevant to all of us to know sort of what directions they're going in, and the sorts of issues and challenges and advice that's being given. Can you just help us by talking through what you're seeing they're doing?
Sure. So, I mean, first, I'll just share that I think at some point most of the major groups in our space and like the MedCom space will either adopt their own stance on artificial intelligence or potentially pick up a position paper or a similar kind of guidance that another organization has already put forth, and most of that will happen within the next, say, 6 months, but just writ large. The ones that I'm directly associated with, either as architect or author at this point, are the ones you mentioned: MAPS, the Healthcare Communications Association here in the UK, as well as the ISMAP organization. And they all those groups are in a position where their membership, and when I say membership, I specifically mean for the most part the biotech, pharmaceutical, medical device, and also agency members are coming to them, and patient engagement, other stakeholders as well are coming to them and to their executive leadership and saying, we're hearing a tremendous amount of concern and consideration out there in the environment around artificial intelligence. To your point, ChatGPT is out there in the world. People don't know what if it is applicable in the consumer sense, if it has appropriateness in our environment, what it's going to do for medical writing, what it means for our authors, what it means for experts. And we can't stay silent. We need to say something. So what is our position as an organization, as a member organization, on these topics? So it's not like the societies were sitting around in the spring and like, we should probably put something out. That's not really what happened. Every one of those bodies was hearing an outcry from their membership saying, we need you to stand up and act and react to this kind of concern that's out there and state in an unequivocal way what kind of good looks like for the membership and provide support and resources in an equivocal fashion so that groups can kind of figure out kind of what good looks like and then where to follow. So a lot of these considerations are responses, if you will, to the membership kind of outcry that emerged in different respects. The HCA one is it was something that probably was initiated first. Mike Dixon, the CEO, came to our foresight committee that I'm part of and was indicating that the membership across the UK was really asking for a disposition as to kind of whether the AI kind of discourse was really somewhat kind of topical or whether it was transformative. And the roadmap that HCA put out probably about 3 weeks ago or so, which I hope folks have had a chance to read, it's out there, published both in the CMRO journal, which is part of Taylor & Francis. It's also published on the HCA website. It does state that AI really is a kind of transformative consideration for healthcare communications broadly, whether that's public relations or disease state education or MedComms or the broader part of the space. And that if groups don't currently have a policy, they don't have a statement or a protocol around AI, they should look to adopt one in the near term. That just working in an environment where there is no kind of stated expectation around AI is probably not the most helpful thing in the world. And there are some suggestions about what that policy should include, what those variables are, and kind of what good looks like from here to follow, if you will. And Liz Mercer's at Langland and myself co-authored that document. And we did a little webinar to follow, kind of talking through some of the considerations for people to think about as they stand that up. But it really is kind of like a catalyst or like a thanks, Peter, for posting that in the chat. A catalyst to think about, hey, like if I'm working in the area and I'm at, an agency, I'm at a consultancy, I'm at a biotech, I'm at a pharma, I'm at a patient advocacy group, and I don't yet have an AI policy, now's probably the time to put one in place and, to think about progressively what that means for me and my staff and reach out for the right resources as things progress, because this isn't going away. It's not going to, the horse is not going to go back in the barn, so to speak. And if we don't support our teams, it's only going to lead to challenges within our organization and for the people we serve. And I think that it was really kind of a kind of trial balloon to kind of float that up and say, this matters and it matters now. The ISMAP organization is a little bit kind of broader in scope. The things that were tasked to us as the task force for ISMAP, so the task force that supports the artificial intelligence work, is it's a little bit more multifunctional, if you will. There are folks on the task force that represent biopharma. There's some folks from Pfizer and from Amgen, some other teams. There's agency side folks. I lead the agency side part as co-chair of the task force. The other co-chair is Keith Goldman from AbbVie. And then there's some technology folks as well as on the AI side, and some folks that represent publishers also. And there are about 10 people on the AI task force. The AI task force for ISMAP has kind of four work streams. The first is around a position statement and roadmap, which is a bit deeper and broader than the HCA statement. It is final. It has been submitted to a journal, and it will be published within a little over a fortnight. I can't state the exact date, but it's coming pretty soon. And in addition to the declarative kind of topical areas that HCA mentioned, it also goes really deep in on the type of artificial intelligence that is recommended for teams within SciComs, publications, MedComs, scientific platforms, and all the rest to adopt, the fact that it needs to be responsible AI, and that there's an expectation, a longitudinal expectation for professional development for everyone in the space moving forward, that it's not a kind of episodic thing, like you go to a ISMAP EU meeting in London and kind of check that box and like, oh, I'm done, that's it. No, it's a lifelong expectation from this point forward that in order to remain current and effective in role, there is an AI expectation that exists moving forward from this point forward. And as ISMAP, we'll continue to provide resources to support that expectation, but it is an expectation to as part of the role moving forward. The second work stream as part of the task force is to actually stand up those resources. So we're working on a major tech partnership to kind of provide that content out to the teams. And that'll be announced hopefully in London at the meeting on January 23rd and 24th in London. Right. We're setting up a new website for competencies like CMPP exam and all the rest that follow. And I saw in the chat some people asked about applications beyond ChatGPT that are relevant to MedComs and SciComs and publications. There are more applications in generative that exist than can be named. There are literally probably 30 to 50 that come out every day, every single day.
Every day.
There are probably about 1,000 literally that exist in generative just in 2023. The ISMAP team, the task force, we are standing up a kind of AI journey, if you will, that will show stakeholders how they get from kind of zero to 100, what they need to do to stand up an AI capability within their organizations, the first step of which is a policy or protocol, the second which is training and development, the third of which is thinking about, do they build a model internally within their organizations, which many companies are doing. We're doing, a lot of the large pharmaceutical companies are doing, et cetera, but not everyone will do. And then from there, what apps or other platforms they need to consider. And we need to kind of think through that journey in order to think about what maturity levels people can actually handle, and then also what they can parse. So those are the major things that ISMAP is doing. It's a longitudinal consideration. The task force will live in perpetuity. It's a lot of work, I will say. And I think for those involved, it's an ongoing commitment, but it's an important one because the space will be transformed by AI. It's not like this, like a one-time thing, like, infographics that are important for people to figure out. And then once they get into the world, it's going to move to the next thing. The AI topic will literally reimagine and transform everything we do. And there's a lot that's kind of considered. To that end, the MAPS work that we've done is also somewhat transformative. It's across everything medical affairs. So it's even bigger than the ISMAP kind of consideration. And MAPS wanted to kind of help the medical affairs audience recognize that there actually has been a lot of artificial intelligence work already, and a lot of generative work already that's been delivered across the universe that people may not be cognizant of. So what we did first was we went out to the members of MAPS, all the industry stakeholders, the partner solution companies like Benizio and consultancies and vendors and tech companies and the rest, and we asked them for case studies of where AI has actually been effective and successful. And we pulled this white paper together that I think was published on the 28th. I think Peter just posted it in the chat. that is really like a compendium of all the successes in AI that exist at present. So when people say, "Oh, well, you know, this AI thing sounds great, but like, you know, how does it actually work in reality?" The MAPS paper showcases what is possible today and what actually works in reality today. And to Peter's point, like the space is changing so fast that yes, these things have been implemented successfully in multiple cases already. But if the paper was published in September, it meant that those things had to have been done at least as late as June. So it's already October. So that, you know, we're already so much more capable in October than we were in June because the tech is evolving so quickly. So if those things were possible in late summer, by the time, you know, Christmas hits, we're almost an order of magnitude stronger in terms of capability than we were in, you know, 2 quarters ago. So, you know, I already noted that a previous colleague of mine is now chairing a similar initiative at EMWA on the Medical Writers Association side to look at the AI disposition across medical writers. There are a couple other similar initiatives we're seeing on the editorial side of things. As I said, there will likely be a similar disposition across the entire stack, across all of MedComms, to adopt a disposition and a stance that suggests that AI is transformative, that folks need to adopt a policy and a position to take on education and training, and then to really start transforming the way they work, you know, as things progress forward. And I think, and we're happy to kind of continue to be part of that work, and you know, to help, you know, provide counsel and consideration to those that are working on their own initiatives as well.
That's great. I was just going to stick that in as well to the chat. Sorry. There's lots of, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, in the spring, there was lots of excitable people talking about this stuff, basically driven by ChatGPT. You know, it was very specific. Then it all went a bit quiet, as far as I could see, and people were starting to sort of like close the doors and say, well, we need to work this out in-house. And then, you know, September, well, we're October, aren't we? October 2023, let's make that point, that's the date that we're talking, because it'll be out of date tomorrow, sort of thing. We're seeing this proliferation of professional organizations and so on providing guidance. I just stuck a quick link in the chat for the ICMGAA. It's worth just acknowledging that bodies like that are sort of incorporating AI type guidance into what they're doing for publications and so on. So I think that's really useful, because I hope a lot of people have gone, oh, that's interesting. You know, these professional organizations doing it, and there's some signposts to where you can get more information, and hopefully if you're members of those organizations, you can get quite involved in those initiatives. Let's just draw back from that, and can we take some specific examples? We've had a number of questions coming in, you know, just, you know, how does, I think Jane asked a question quite quickly, you know, take something like a symposium, how can you apply AI to a symposium? What do people mean when they're talking about that? Can you talk around that? You know, what are the sort of specific sort of things in which you might do?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many possible examples. It's hard to kind of pinpoint one. But I mean, they're depending upon, you know, kind of what your role is and, you know, kind of what you're being asked to kind of support. You know, there are things that can be considered with regards to the content. There are things that can be considered with regards to audience generation. There are things that can be considered with regards to faculty preparation and delivery. There are things that can be considered in terms of learning transfer. You know, say someone delivers a symposium in Copenhagen or in Rome or in Bristol or somewhere else, and actually have a role to play, right? Maybe they're an investigator or they're a clinician. They actually see patients at some point. The intention, I would imagine, is that they go back and, you know, to their job, to their, you know, practice, and they apply that learning into the place of care, and they improve someone's health. You know, the learning transfer from symposia back to practice is a bit weak at present. You know, there are a number of considerations from a generative perspective that can help with that kind of far transfer from symposia to place of care. A lot of the dialing back a bit, the way that we think about generative, and the way that I think most people are thinking about it, is it's probably better to start thinking about the places within our work, and or, you know, you can think about the places within your own personal world, like not even so much within MedComms, but just like what you do as a person, where either you find a lot of friction, you know, where things just, you know, don't go as easily as they should, or where it's like a little bit difficult to come up with ideas for things that are requested either by the team, by client, by others. And you know that the team struggled to kind of come up with meaningful value in those regards. Like say for symposia, like one of the things that you hear a fair amount with symposia, I used to do symposia all the time in a previous life, is that you know if you go to any symposia, any given therapeutic area, like you know ESMO is live and right now-ish, if you will, Madrid, you know most of the symposia, say in oncology, and the titles for symposia end up sounding almost like cookie cutter images of each other all the time. Like, it doesn't matter how what people kind of try to do, but they sound pretty similar to each other after a time or two. So, you know, naming titles of symposia so that they sound distinct from each other, so that they don't kind of accidentally plagiarize a previous title, and that they actually indicate what's being discussed so that the attendees know what is indicated and they actually show up, is actually a little bit more of an art than it is a science. And you know, a lot of teams struggle with this. Like they struggle with trying to figure out like the right way to name a symposia. Generative is actually quite good at this. And it is something that requires a little bit of finesse, a little bit of prompt engineering, so to speak, if you will. You can't just go into ChatGPT or any generative tool and say, like, give me the symposia title for my ESMO symposium in Madrid. Like, first of all, the platform doesn't know who you are, what your brief is, what molecule you're supporting, what the learning objectives are, what the strategic or scientific platform is you're looking to communicate. It's not a magic wand. It doesn't like read your mind yet. You know, we just give it 5 to 8 years, but that's a little joke. But it doesn't anticipate that. So you have to develop a rapport and a relationship with the platform to help it understand what your context and content is. But after some time, it can definitely put forward multiple suggestions that far extend the aperture, if you will, the remit, far beyond what the team's able to come up with on their own, which may not be the things you actually use, you know, externally, but they could be things that are like a starter for 10. Like they help you think about what's possible. And generative is really great at providing like a complementary or alternative perspective. It may not be like having like another like Robert or Jane on your team, like another person, another human on the team, but having this AI perspective, this augmented perspective that's so far off the course than what you ever would have thought about, that it makes you kind of like think about like, oh, I never even would have thought about, you know, suggesting a zebra as like the way of identifying a rare disorder. But now thinking that way makes me think of 5 other things that I wouldn't have thought about. And now I'm going to pick one of those. And that might be a horrible example because people do actually think about zebras all the time for rare disorders. But you get my point. And like it really helps you think tremendously for ways that people talk about, like overcoming writer's block or really thinking out of the box and like really kind of forcing people to kind of go down lines of inquiry that otherwise may not be explored. And those types of things are relatively cheap, both with time and expense, and do create value quickly. On the speaker efficacy side, there are ways of using generative to help the users, like yourself, the team, the client, the speaker, prepare for delivering content so that when they actually share education with an audience, that what they share in the room is significantly more effective and engaging than what they would have shared just kind of getting a set of slides and kind of walking to the room and delivering them, and almost using the platform as a simulation or like a way of kind of improving self-efficacy. Again, it requires some engagement to get to that point, but you know the utility is far beyond what kind of the default proposition is. So we could have a 4-hour conversation about all the things you could use generative for in a symposium. The problem is not finding use cases. It's prioritizing the use cases to the ones that are of most import for you and the team, and then helping the subject matter experts on your team develop the kind of AI skill set, the prompt engineering skill set, to pull those out alongside the things that are of import so they create value for you and your client.
I think that's really interesting. And you've covered an awful lot of ground in there, I think, very quickly. And I think probably give some people some food for thought. There's quite a lot of chat going on in the chat now and people talking to each other, which I think is quite interesting. But one of the frustrations I have when I'm talking to people is that, you know, in our business, people tend to jump to, is AI going to take my job as a medical writer? Is it going to write this thing for me? Therefore, I'm no longer required. And I mean, and I've seen some very fiery conversations around this sort of thing, but I think it sort of misses the point a little bit. And Having said that, I'm not entirely sure it couldn't do some of the work for us, but it's about this tool and ideation and so on and so forth. But one of the things that really gets me is how many people get excitable about this topic, but haven't actually tried and played and done something. And I just wonder what your observations on that are. And as a comment from where you sit, I mean, I haven't heard it very recently, but not so long ago, I was hearing about organizations that simply went, "Ye cannot touch ChatGPT because of sensitivity," and so on. And my message to people is play with the damn thing, even if it's just on your own at home personally or something. If you don't play with it, you don't even start to understand what's possible with these sorts of generative models. So, just from your perspective, what happens within Inizio? What happens as you see it across the landscape in terms of people either playing or not? And specifically, because that leads into the questions that are coming up about confidentiality and sensitivity and so on. So, maybe just a couple minutes on that.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, like the first consideration for everything is definitely, confidentiality and, private data, patient data, and those rules are different in every jurisdiction. So, what is permissible in the UK is different from what it might be in France, different in the US, different in Singapore, et cetera, et cetera. So, those things definitely take precedence. But that being said, there will come a time in the not too distant future when every major organization has an AI platform that they're leveraging. And when that time comes, to not put information into artificial intelligence when there are considerations to speed time to decision, to improve efficiency and effectiveness when the alternative exists, will be a disservice to humankind. But to Peter's point, like you can't really make an opinion about something, anything, whether it's ChatGPT or an air fryer, unless you use it. Like it doesn't matter what it is. And it's in this space, you can really tell who's used something by their opinions about it and how often they've used it. I said early, and you can see podcasts, interviews I did back in February and March on this topic, that you won't really develop an experience or an opinion about generative if you haven't gotten really frustrated with it, like almost yelling at it, if you will. And also, if you haven't like almost stood up and said, "This is unbelievable and amazing. I can't believe this is even possible." If you haven't gone to like both of those ends of the spectrum where you're like so really almost angry at a platform and also so amazed that this is even possible. If you don't have that range of emotion, then you haven't used it enough. We do within Inizio. So my role is kind of like split in three across the organization. About a third of it is the type of stuff Peter's asking about, which I call kind of like innovation catalyst work, where we're helping groups recognize what's possible and speeding them on the AI journey, if you will. The middle part of my work is focused on doing experiments across Inizio Medical, where we support AI experimentation across the organization. We have probably over 250 experiments that we're doing right now just across our division, where teams are using generative in lots of different ways. We have a partnership with OpenAI. We have internal partnerships that we've done with other teams. We have external partnerships with different platforms, and people are testing every possible thing under the sun in MedComms, you can imagine. And one of the teams I was with earlier this week, and she said something to me. She's like, "Before I came into this pilot, I was," and she's in the UK. She said, she's like, "I was really worried that, ChatGPT was going to take my job. I don't have that fear at all anymore. Now I'm really just focused on how I can use and kind of understand and appreciate the way that generative thinks, so that it can be like a colleague, almost like a junior colleague on the team." And like that actually is like a huge win for us, because when people think, without experience, that it's a threat, it's a huge blocker and a problem, because it's first of all, it's completely unfounded and not true at all, and just it's like almost silly. Because when you use it for any length of time, you realize it's not a threat. And then when you get past that and realize that it actually can be quite helpful and a real complement, that and the real focus is on training and on development and thinking about enablement and how our work processes change as a result, then that's where the real value is. And to Peter's point, when the only way to get there, the only way is not by listening to this chat. The only way is by dipping in deep on the actual platforms, either if your company allows it within your environment, or you find the things that you're really passionate about personally. Those things could be, like for me, it's music, but it could be sports, it could be cooking, it could be travel, whatever you do personally that you really love, there are generative applications in that environment that you will find value in And when you find them personally, the same type of considerations apply to work. This isn't like in 2014 or 2009 when you could do a little bit of AI, you know, in the biopharma world and it just lived there. Now, everything that is generative is a societal issue. It's not just a life sciences issue. That we kind of take our work home with us. If you see that, you know, you can find recipes or make new recipes at home for you and your family that you couldn't have done before, that's an example of innovation and efficiency. That same example applies to coming up with new content for a publication or coming up with content for a slide deck, that it's a little tiny bit removed, like, you know, the hard right, if you will, but it's not so far removed that it's impossible. It's just a slight way of changing the way we think.
The risk of asking a stupid question, in a company like Inizio, is prompt engineering now a thing? Do you have prompt engineers, or do you teach people prompt engineering? Do they see it as a skill? Is it a word? Is it a phrase that's used? Is it a thing?
It is a thing. We do have prompt engineers. We've had them for a long time. We don't have nearly enough. I wish we had 10x more than we do have. I've wished it for over a year. We've added many, many, many more than we had, you know, a year ago. We can't get, you know, that role fast enough. I don't think any company on planet Earth can get them fast enough. Honestly, it's probably the most coveted position on planet Earth. And I have this kind of secret hope that the role shouldn't exist and that the role will go away and that they'll find a way to bake the skill set into the platform and that it won't actually be directly desired. But the longer that this goes on, I think the more likely it is that hope of mine won't be seen through and you actually will need to have that as a skill set. I think, you know, there are two different like types of prompt engineering flavors, if you will, and they're not the same. Like there's a type that helps modify the underlying models that come from the big tech companies. And in those cases, you really need like deep in data science, people that are trained in machine learning and prompt engineering, data engineering, and the rest to help kind of refine a model for implementation across a specific use case. Like, you know, think, for example, like, you know, trying to identify and really suggest like a publication plan in a therapeutic area that hasn't had really much in it for 20 years. Like that's a very bespoke use case, and building a model for that requires a lot of heavy data science. That's a very specialized skill set versus like someone that's parsing an existing model, like say ChatGPT or, you know, Bard or Anthropic or AskPy or one of the other models, to come up with a couple of symposium titles for ESMO. That does require some skill, but the skill to get to the latter is like maybe 2 to 5 hours of prompt engineering training versus the former, which is hundreds of hours of training, maybe, you know, master's or doctoral level education. So it's a very different consideration. Both are in high demand across the industry right now, and not just our industry, every vertical across every company on the planet.
I've got one eye on the comments and questions that are flying around. There's some very specific ones flying around. So we're not going to cover all this off, and I we're never going to. So I hope everybody's appreciating and thinking about what we're talking about. And I know I can talk for you and people can reach out to you. LinkedIn's an easy way and so on. There's just got to be more discussion about this, more yeah. Playing with it, more experimentation and so on. Let's just throw one question at you from where you sit. There's concern over, and let's stick with the ChatGPT type of environment. There's concern over plagiarism and so on. You know, can you just talk a little bit to that? We've got a couple of questions that have come in. You know, is it plagiarizing? How do you, and importantly, I've seen examples or discussions on LinkedIn and elsewhere where people have talked about, well, specifically, let's take a specific example. Pharma company has taken my manuscript, put it through an AI detector, come back to me and said 80% of this is generated by AI. Therefore, you have not done your job. There's quite a bit in there, but can you just talk to that sort of an issue? Which, and again, it scares people a little bit, I think. But, you know, can you detect AI in that? I mean, I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I mean, it's posh, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really, you know, difficult topic because there are so many like nuances and specific areas within the topic that it's challenging to answer quickly. I'll try. First, the plagiarism topic is more a parent for our children in schools than it is for us in med comms. Because the you really shouldn't be using ChatGPT directly in med comms, hard stop. You shouldn't be using it, period, in med comms, hard stop. One, because it isn't built for a medical audience, and the output is not written for a technical or patient audience. It's like the example I use, and if you've ever heard me speak, I say this all the time. It's like using your automobile to cook an omelet. Like you could open up the boot and like, if that's the right word, and I was using the wrong UK expressions, but like the you could open up the hood of the car and like try to heat the car up and cook an egg on the engine, and eventually you'll make an omelet, but that's not the intended purpose. ChatGPT is a consumer app with consumer language, and it is not trained specifically for that purpose. So if you accidentally create something that's readable, that's not what it's for, and it's not meant for that intention. So that is not the right use at all, and no one should be doing it for that purpose at all. There are a number of purpose-built apps for scientific,
Okay.
technical, medical, med comms, medical affairs, but ChatGPT is not one of them. There are
Okay.
a number of the biopharma companies out there now have purpose-built generative models that use the model that underpins ChatGPT, that have been fine-tuned and prompt-tuned, that is engineered specifically for medcoms, that it's not ChatGPT, but it's built from what underpins ChatGPT. Those things are purpose-built for medcoms. So, for example, AbbVie has one of these. Johnson and Johnson has one of these. Pfizer is building one. Merck has one of them. Merck in the U.S., not Serono. There are a number of companies that have these purpose-built medcoms models. If they submitted your paper through, for example, in those cases, yes, they can align almost like as a comparison. If they see what comes through their model and what you've come through, to see like what portion of the text is in their model versus what's in your model, but it's not detecting how much is AI written versus how much is human written. Those types of detection models are notoriously weak and invalid, and every major AI body renders them useless. They're not helpful. They only are used by like professional societies and other organizations to try to squeeze out AI writing. They have no validity, and they're not accepted by any organization. It's the way that the field is moving for AI, what's called provenance, is to raise up and make explicit the components of the final work that are contributed by AI. That's called provenance. So that when you, as the viewer, and this could be in med comms, it could be when you're watching the BBC, when you're watching, TV, when you're looking at social media, it'll be really clear to you in the final deliverable what components were contributed by AI versus what were contributed by a human. And you'll be able to see either through a watermark or through what they're calling like a metadata raise, like a little like tag on the top right part of the corner of the image. How much came from AI, how much came from human, and that's going to be universal across everything you see from 2024 on, whether it's watching the news, looking at something on Instagram, or a paper, because people are going to want to say how much of this is human created, how much is AI created, and the rest. But that's intentional, like what goes into the thing. It's not what comes out, it's only what goes in. And that governance, that provenance, is going to become a universal expectation.
Okay. That is opening up a bit of a Pandora's box of issues, isn't it? I knew we were going to run out of time. I wanted to just, in the last minute or two, this is a big ask as well, but Matt, I know that you talk about, is this a fair thing to end on? You talk about reimagining med comms. And I just wondered whether you could just say, for the last minute or two, what you mean when you're talking about reimagining med comms.
Yeah, I mean, this is not my kind of a creation, if you will. If you go and sit around a generative AI table often enough, like I do, you'll hear other leaders within their businesses, whether it's in retail or finance or defense or telecoms or the government. I was with someone from NASA in the U.S. recently at a conference, and they say when you start thinking about what's possible with generative, you start thinking about things like content or simulation or efficiency or effectiveness. and you think about what you can do with generative in those cases and actually make those changes to someone's role, you change, you know, 10% on efficiency, 10% on effectiveness, 10% on self-efficacy or training. Soon, if you've changed 30% of someone's job, is that really still their job? After 30, a third of your job has changed, is that really still the same job? Most people would probably say, no, that's like the next job I'm going to do. It's like my promotion job. So, and a lot of the things we're doing with these experiments internally are looking to like remedy or really renovate at least a quarter to half of someone's role. So when you, when you're doing that, when you're kind of really juxtaposing this like innovation regime on top of someone's work, it's really thinking about like, what will the work look like in 18 months, in 3 years, in 5 years? And if it changes by a half, that's not the same job. It's a transformed or reimagined work. And it's nothing more, you know, kind of momentous than that. It's just, you know, if the work today is really great and important, MedComms is the thing that allows for novel science to reach clinicians and investigators so patients can derive value. If we can do that more efficiently and effectively in a way that people enjoy greater, let's do it. That's really important. Yeah. That's like God's work. We should do it. But in doing it, it's going to change how we work. It's going to change the way we work. And the way we work is going to become what we call smarter, because if we can do it more efficiently and people enjoy it more and it's effective more, then it's going to be reimagined. That's pretty much the whole thing.
Okay. And I think that, and it does come back down to a point we've made in different ways during that conversation. People need to go out and embrace this to then allow that to be realized. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw a comment.
It's exciting times.
Yeah. I mean, it is. I saw a comment in the chat. Someone said, like, you know, institutions need to support education. They totally do. But we do, everyone does. But, you know, there is a personal responsibility here as well. It's not an either or thing. It's a both and thing. You know, the institutions definitely need to provide education 100%. But people do also need to take some personal responsibility. I'm not saying, like, you know, in the course of a weekend, like that, you know, every waking hour, people need to be, you know, scurrying up education and AI. But it would be worthwhile for people to start thinking, you know, download an app here or there, like try to think about, you know, if they're watching golf or they're watching, you know, football in the UK, like, you know, if the narration is from generative, they understand a little bit more about where that comes from or what's coming out of it. So they're educated as a consumer. Those things will help in the workplace because the whole world is being transformed. It's not just MedComms.
Right. Okay. Right. Look, we're way over time. We'll start losing people. We should draw a line there. I find it all fascinating. I'm not quite sure where we're going to end up, but I'm really, really delighted you've been able to join us and talk, because it's just fascinating listening to you. I think it's also just valuable that we've been able to put out there where we're at with some of those professional organizations and the sorts of guidance that's coming through. There's a ton of stuff in the comments and questions which we can look at later. I'll say to anyone online today or watching this later on, please do make contact. Matt, I know you're very happy for people to talk to you. LinkedIn is an easy way to do so. Everybody play, engage, you know, within your organizations, within the professional organizations and so on, and let's have more open discussion about these sorts of, all this amazing array of options to use these amazing tools. But for now, I'm going to say a huge thank you. So a quick wave, Matt, and we'll say goodbye to everybody. Take care. Bye.